Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Dar Jamail returns with more on our climate crisis, what we can do about it, and what we have to learn from Indigenous peoples. I hope you'll stay tuned. During Iraq War No. 2, Dar Jamail decided to travel to Iraq to see and report back on what was actually happening. While all other U.S. reporters were, quote, embedded, unquote, with the U.S. military machine, Jamail was reporting honestly and accurately about what actually was happening. For the past 7 or 8 years, Jamail has been investigating our global climate catastrophe, its causes, its effects, and the possibilities of mitigating it. His 2019 book on the subject is titled The End of Ice. A month ago, we heard a good talk Jamail gave on the subject. He spoke in Syracuse, New York, in April 2019. A striking thing in the talk was Jamail's emphasis on Indigenous peoples and the many things we need to learn from them. And we'd better learn them fast if we want our grandchildren to live to adulthood. We might start by listening for the singing of Nis Nisa. This is a spirit some Indigenous Americans believe resides in Mount Shasta. Nis Nisa watches over the balance of humankind, the earth, and the universe. When the balance is good, you can hear Nis Nisa singing. When the balance goes off, Nis Nisa's singing becomes faint or stops. When the balance is off, Nis Nisa may also help you discover what you personally should do to help restore the balance. Even if you don't actually believe that Nis Nisa literally exists, you have to admit it's a really good metaphor. Personally, I'm very close to being a believer. Today we will hear the question and answer session that followed Jamail's talk, minus the questions. Jamail begins with a topic that didn't get discussed in his main speech, glaciers, and the awful methane feedback loops attending their loss. After that, he's on to the insanity of geoengineering. Nis Nisa, the insanity of business-as-usual consumerism. White versus Indigenous responses to the crisis, what he hopes to accomplish with his book, and more. Here is Dar Jamail.
Glaciers, just briefly, glaciers are melting away apace. I mean, most people here are probably aware of what's happened in Alaska, which literally is record wildfires as we speak, literally. I was looking at the news earlier, and all across the state right now, just massive wildfires, and especially even up in the Arctic Circle, unprecedented amounts of wildfires of literally the tundra burning in other parts, and record CO2 emissions from those specific wildfires in the Arctic. So a critical thing to understand when we talk about feedback loops is the permafrost contains more carbon, more CO2 equivalent by far than what we've already emitted into the atmospheres. And it's melting as of right now, actually, or a study that just came out, I was just writing about it earlier, it's already thawing at a pace that it wasn't expected to hit until 2070. So it's far, far ahead. That means that feedback loop of as it thaws and it releases that CO2 into the atmosphere, which of course contributes to further warming, which causes it to thaw more, so that's a feedback loop. The Arctic sea ice, for the first time in recorded history, there is no Arctic sea ice in Alaska waters. So that's 150 miles north of the Alaska coast. There's no sea ice. This is a big deal because the sea ice, and this is the feedback loop that probably most people have been aware of for a long time, it reflects sunlight back into the atmosphere. As it recedes, it reflects less sunlight, which instead goes in to the exposed dark ocean, which absorbs it and warms and melts the sea ice faster, which then reflects less, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Another way to understand feedback loops, I interviewed a USGS scientist, Dr. Dan Fagry at Glacier National Park, and he said basically the more something happens, the more something happens, which in this respect makes sense. And so the subsea permafrost in the Arctic, in the shallow seabeds around the whole Arctic Ocean, contain massive amounts of what are called methane hydrates, which is essentially methane trapped in tiny bubbles in the ice. As those waters warm, as the sea ice recedes and expose more of the ocean to warming, then that is already being released up. And I cite one scientist in the book, Natalia Shikova. She used to be with UA Fairbanks, and she published a study quite a few years ago, actually, warning basically a methane bomb. She called it a methane burp, where you could literally have a 50 gigaton burp of methane in a matter of minutes as all that keeps getting exposed, like the Eastern Siberian Shelf or in the Barents Sea, etc. And she basically said that could happen at any time, which would probably cause an immediate increase, a near immediate increase in a matter of single digit years of 1 to 3 or 4 C temperature increase for the planet. I interviewed another scientist who's been affiliated with NASA, Dr. Ira Leifer, who's a methane expert. And he actually had used NASA satellites to track methane around the Arctic for years and years and years, and still is. And he published a study already back in 2012, I believe is the date on that one. And the normal background rate of methane plumes coming up from the seabed, because there is a normal background rate, is I think around 3,000 to 5,000 over a 1,000 square kilometer area. And he had already tracked a 1,000 square kilometer area in the Barents Sea that he had logged 60 million methane plumes. So point is it's already happening. The question is, when does it speed up faster, and do we have a major release all at once? So these are the things of most concern in the Arctic. And then moving over to Greenland, right now we had a day recently, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago now, where it set a record melt day for one day. It was 12.5 billion tons of water in one day. Another way to think about that, it was so much melting in Greenland that one day contributed, I believe it was a tenth of a millimeter to sea level rise for the planet. I mean, a tenth of a millimeter doesn't sound like a whole lot, but for the planet in one day, that is how fast things are happening. And Greenland, it used to be unthinkable. Well, if all of it melts, that's just over 20 feet of global sea level rise. It used to be unthinkable that that was possible. Okay, part of it, sure. Now, more and more scientists are saying probably all of it. The question's just when. And then I'll touch on glaciers real quick. So the short news about glaciers is that, as Dr. Dan Fagry said at Glacier National Park, essentially, we're on a trajectory to have no more functional glaciers in that park by 2030, so under 11 years from now. And then he cited a study, which I have in the book, the contiguous 48, probably no glaciers by 2100 anywhere. And I live in Washington State, so that's pretty shocking when I get to look at Mount Rainier and there's over 100 glaciers in Olympic National Park, which is basically my backyard, and North Cascades National Park. No more glaciers. And then if we talk about what that means around the rest of the world, another study that I like to cite, the Hindu Kush region of the Himalaya, major ice field there, major glaciation. It's the head of several of Asia's major rivers, serves water, drinking water and irrigation water for 1.5 billion people. Recent studies show that area could be largely ice-free by 2100. And that means most of the water in those rivers is gone or extremely, extremely reduced. We can't live where there's no water. So where do those 1.5 billion people go? And then what happens to the areas where they go? Where's that water and food come from? Where do they live, et cetera, et cetera? So there are these cascading effects that we all need to start thinking about when we think, you know, we just think about what's happening, because all these environmental factors have very, very real impact on us. So there's several chapters in the book on that, but thanks for bringing that up. First, I want to address geoengineering, because there's been some people writing about this as though it's some sort of a solution. All the scientists I've spoken with about it are scared to death of it, and I think the hubris and the conceitedness and the human-centeredness of it and the insanity is off the charts. I mean, essentially, the climate crisis is geoengineering. We have geoengineered this by changing how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, changing the temperatures and the acidity level of the oceans. So we've geoengineered our way into this mess, and some people think somehow we can literally tweak this and that on the earth or in the clouds or dumping shavings in the ocean or particulate in the high atmosphere to buy us a little bit more time. And all the scientists I've spoken with about this think it's absolute insanity. You're going to find plenty that support it. I know some that did think it was crazy and then now are supporting it because they understand that we're already off the cliff. And if we at least have one play left with a Hail Mary, we should at least throw the Hail Mary, even if the consequences could be even more catastrophic. You know, one person in particular thinks we need to do everything we can to refreeze that Arctic sea ice because we cannot let the methane major releases happen. Once that does, then it's truly over. I understand that, the survival instinct, but I think, you know, going in and tweaking Mother Earth yet again is not going to be a good idea. And as far as looking at our own lives and making our own fundamental changes and question, I think it is. It's time to question everything. I mean, you know, it's, I joke about, hey, here we are in the apocalypse, but, you know, another way to use that word is essentially means the great revealing or pulling back of the curtain. And everything is up now. Yeah, I mean, the silver lining of Trump is all of these systemic, huge problems that have been in this country from first contact on, you know, a country built on genocide and slavery, and then everything that's come with that, and the denial of those, and then everything that's come with that, all of these issues that are up have to be addressed. And that's why it's not a cop-out, but I feel like the best, I'll tell you why I keep ending with the Mises story, and it's this, and I'm going to get borderline a little bit woo-woo here, but the Earth, in indigenous thinking, is obviously a living being, and she is part of us, and we are part of her. And if we all, in theory, go out and listen very, very diligently and comport ourselves the right way, and then we get those messages of, here's what I feel very strongly that I need to do, whatever it is, then the Earth is the organizing factor. And we're each going to have our own specific task, custom built for us and what we do and what we're good at. And then that's what we're supposed to go do. Because all of these things need to be addressed and everything needs to be questioned and most things need to be changed. And I think this is that moment. And it's going to be up to each one of us doing everything that we possibly can. And for me now, it means going into another project that I'm working on with Stan and working with young people. Because for me, putting everything I have into helping them and preparing them and doing what I can to support them, that's my calling right now. And that's a new thing for me because I'm basically getting out of journalism and that's what I'm going to start doing. And that's come again from my own listening, which I have to keep doing. So that's why I just keep encouraging people to do that. He brings up the business as usual continuing and people keeping buying bigger vehicles and emitting more CO2 mindlessly, et cetera. Some of them intentionally. That's why I like to bring up the Wetiko disease in my talks because it's the only way I can understand this because, you know, that person's so checked out that they won't think that, you know, I'm engaging in an action that ultimately is going to imperil my own life. I mean, they won't even think about that. But that's the reality of the situation when you understand how far along we are, what's happening on all these different levels. And so just to help understand it and what to do about those people, I don't know. I just keep busy with my own work. There's other countries that are starting to take adaptation measures that are... One example I like to use is I live in Port Townsend, Washington. It's a small, very progressive community on the northeast tip of the Olympic Peninsula. And a lot of people there like to think, hey, you know, voted like 90% for Bernie during the primaries, during the lead up to 2016. And most people there understand the climate crisis and get it, right, for sure. Yet the best thing the city could do for sea level rise is the Main Street, aptly named Water Street, is at 6 feet elevation. That's where there's all these historic buildings and all these businesses that the town relies on for tourism, which is essentially one of its primary sources of income. And the best thing they could come up with was last summer engage in a project where they dumped millions of dollars into tearing up Water Street, redoing the electrical and the sewage underneath it. If you look out to the west coast of Washington State, the Quinault tribe, President Fawn Sharp, who was elected in 2006 and is now in her fourth term, the second she got elected and knew what was going on with the climate, those two villages out there right at sea level, she immediately started moving them uphill to 100 feet elevation. Which of these makes more sense? And I think that calls into question the leadership, patriarchy, white privilege, thinking our money's going to protect us, all of this. So, I mean, those are two really, really good examples. And so I think solutions that are going to happen on a community level are going to be smaller or with an Indian tribe and things like that. I don't know of any nation states that are responding anywhere near the level of urgency that is needed right now. Obviously, you know, some countries in Europe are at least doing some better things, but it still falls far short. You know, I mean, the dominant system, it's a fossil fuel global capitalist economy, and it basically means the people pulling the levers of power now wouldn't make as much money or would have to move into something completely different. And the last drop of oil will be the most profitable. So they're not going to change unless they're forced to change. Why did I write the book and what did I kind of hope might happen as a result, and who is my audience, and what might move people? I wrote the book for an audience that already understands what's happening, but that wanted to know more about it, and people that maybe couldn't go. I mean, I was extremely lucky, fortunate, and privileged to go to all these places and get to see all this firsthand and write about it. So I wanted to bring these places to people who couldn't go there and give them a very visceral, an emotional description of what it's like to see and feel this happening to these very important, majestic places on the planet. And my sole hope for the book was that people would read it and want to go back outside and just reconnect. Because I think what moves people is love and loving the planet. Not fear, not panic, not hate, but love. Like, if you have a kid, you know, I do not have any of my own children, but I just had a 16-year-old nephew come up, and I got to spend 4 days with him and take him into the mountains and have some big talks with him. And I love this kid. And I said, I'm committed to do whatever I can to help you, because he totally gets what's going on. And that is a moral obligation for me to go do. Again, damn the results, can't control them anyway, they're out of my hands, but what can I do in any realm to try to help in any way for this kid and other children on the planet? I mean, how can you not see the student strikes and not be shaken and moved that, you know, these 17-year-old kids are like demanding that adults act like adults and take care of the damn planet? You know, it's absurd, but that's where we are. And so I want, ideally, if people are just motivated by love for what they care about, whether the planet or whatever their most important political cause is, whatever it is, pick one of the thousand that's screaming in our face right now and go take action on it like our lives depend on it, because they do. So I think that's where I'm coming from. And on that note, I like to try to slip into the Q&A another piece of writing from Stan. This is called Earth Prayer, and it just feels like an appropriate time, and then I'll get more questions. Let us just see it simply. Enough to drink in spring's radiance, the yellow scotch broom against green fields. Allow our eyes to reach into the morning like fingers into wet grass, our tears falling into April's rain. We've been too long away, and the need is huge. Our desire unsteady in this time. Let the invisible wanting burst to the surface of our skin, where we may know this world who holds us so dearly, even in the middle of our blindness and in the beginnings of our awakening. Let us lie face down in her beauty, feeding her with our gratitude. She is waiting. The question is essentially, what have the indigenous people that I've come into contact with while working on the book asked us to do? And one primary thing is to be allies. Another one is to bring attention to the fact that the country's built on genocide and slavery and actively work to overcome this denialism that's part of the dominant culture that tries to pretend like these things didn't happen and so much is still happening. That's a primary core thing. And another is essentially to act like our lives depend on it and take action like our lives depend on it. And to understand that they as a people have already lived through a genocide, a full-on genocide. And the fact is that as we saw at Standing Rock, that any real revolutionary change that's going to happen in the future is going to be led by women and indigenous people. That's just how it is, because that's how it was in the past, and that's what works. And as we know from so many of the tribal cultures in the past and present, being matrilineal and in some cases even matriarchal, and that the women made the decisions on to whether there was going to be a war or not and this kind of thing and how far away the dominant culture is from that. So remembering things like that, and that's why for me, as I mentioned, my next project is working real close with Stan on a book to bring all of that out. So we're literally going around and interviewing Fawn Sharp, who I mentioned, the chief, the president of the Quinault tribe in Western Washington, people like her, young people, old people, people in community, people out on their own, but all indigenous. That's what I'm doing, because I feel like, you know, these voices that have been silenced can't, you know, those are the voices we need to be listening to and taking direction from. So the question is, the point is essentially, the scientists that I've spoken with, are they talking about what might happen as things progress and then whether humans, are we going to make it or not? So is it human extinction or planetary extinction? Nobody knows for sure. I mean, there's plenty of scientists that have very strong opinions about this. There's some people that think absolutely humans are going away no matter what. And I believed that for a long time, up until about a year ago. And then I'm only speaking about myself here. But I personally had to recognize that was extremely arrogant and we've not ever been here as a species, and that I couldn't say that for sure. Yes, you know, humans are for sure going to not make it through this. I even put in the book, it looks likely that humans will not make it through this, but I cannot say for sure. And as long as there's any X factor out there at all, if people are looking for hope, that would be it, that there is this X factor of not knowing, and that's why we have to work like our lives depend on it, because they do. What I know from many of the scientists that I interviewed for this book is a lot of them believe that there's going to be a mass die-off of humans, that there's going to be several billion people going away. I mean, if you just look at what's already happening with our ability to grow food, shifting weather patterns, what's happening to the insects, that there's no way we're not going to be going through a very tight keyhole as a species. The question is how many of us make it through it. And then the long-term prognosis of the planet, something's going to continue. Somehow life is going to continue. I feel confident about that. But, you know, who am I to say, and what's that going to look like? I don't think anybody can say that for sure. I, for a long time, had felt, and I'll work that question in, or that point into this, well, if we fail, you know, the planet will be better off without us anyway. And, you know, I'm 50 years old, I've had a great life, I've gotten to, you know, do so many things, but to my 16-year-old nephew, that's really not a good thing for me to say. Because he's asking, like, well, what about us? Or, you know, these young kids that are like, well, you know, what are we going to do? And I think that, yeah, I mean, it might end up turning out that way, but I just wouldn't feel comfortable saying that to a young kid right now, that with everything at play and everything that's at stake, that we owe our lives. I think I have to dedicate my life to those future generations now, and doing whatever I can to try to give them a chance. So I'll paraphrase that and probably put it back. Where does the anger come in to stop the people that are doing the damage, in short? And I think, obviously, that's a realm that, you know, why I just tell people to go listen. I have no answers for anybody other than my own. And I don't even get those myself. I listen for them. And so if people feel moved, well, that's their job then, is to go after and stop those people doing the harm. Do it. What I hear is a lot of emotion around the fact of the gravity of the crisis and what's already baked into the system and what's coming down the tracks towards us that's inevitable. And to me, that's not, okay, F it, I'm going to just go party and burn, you know, fly and whatever. That means, to me, it means, like another analogy I use, having spent a lot of time guiding on Denali, if I've got a team at high camp at 17,000 feet and I just got a radio report from NOAA that the biggest storm ever is coming at the mountain and we don't have time to descend and we've got X amount of food and fuel and we can dig in a camp and who's here and who can do what, I have to be very honest with people. Here's what's coming, guys. Odds are we won't even make it through this, but here's what we've got. So you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and you know, and we're going to team together, and we're going to do everything we can to try to make it through this. You can't stop it. It's about accepting. That's what I said at the start. Do we not want an accurate map of where we are? And I have, as a journalist, done the best I can in this book to line out the most accurate map with the leading scientists in all these phases that I go into to show people, here's where we are. Now, that should bring a sense of clarity and purpose and urgency to everything that we do. To what my activism is, to who I love, to how, you know, am I wasting my time? Am I really doing something I don't really want to be doing? I think, in effect, it brings a crystallization of everything in my life that wasn't there before, and a sense of urgency to act and take care of what's left and fight like I've never fought before.
Dar Jamail speaking movingly on responding to our climate catastrophe. He spoke in Syracuse on April 11, 2019. Wilton Vaught, producer of Essential Dissent, made that excellent recording of the proceedings, and many thanks for that. You can find more of Wilton's work on iTunes, YouTube, radioforall.net, and elsewhere. Just do a search for Essential Dissent. And you can find more of New World Notes. Just mosey on over to newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, reminding you that you are not alone, and hoping you will tune in again next week. Till then.